It is Tuesday, February 9th, Universal Time, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, we'll get an update from our correspondent in the northeastern U.S. state of New Hampshire on the final hours of voting in the nation's first primary of the 2016 presidential election cycle. We'll speak to a Middle East analyst about why Russian intervention in Syria appears to be changing the tide of the Syrian civil war. And our reporter in Hong Kong gives us an update on what was behind the city's worst street violence in more than a year. It's all ahead on International Edition. Well, there are just hours to go in the primary election in the state of New Hampshire, where Republicans and Democrats are vying for their party's nominations for the 2016 presidential election. Earlier, I spoke to our national correspondent in Manchester, New Hampshire, Jim Malone, and I asked him what was the mood of the voters with just hours to go.
Well, there's a great deal of anticipation about the results and what they're going to show. And even though the polls have shown for some time that Donald Trump is the leading Republican candidate and Bernie Sanders has a big lead on the Democratic side, I think any time you're talking about New Hampshire, the primary, and the voters here, given their independent, unpredictable ways, you really want to wait to see the results before you kind of take a deep look at what the state has said. So many times in the past, New Hampshire has surprised people, and I think there's a possibility, maybe not in terms of who will win on either side, but who might come in the Republican primary after Trump. The order of the candidates finish, I think there's possibility there for some real surprises.
And what kind of surprises are you sensing might happen based on the conversations that you and the team have had in New Hampshire?
I think what you're hearing a lot of is who will finish behind Donald Trump on the Republican side. And in New Hampshire, with its more moderate voting population on the Republican side and the fact that independents can freely vote in the primaries here, I think we're going to be looking at the three Republican governors to see if they can break through in New Hampshire, where they did not do so well in Iowa. And we're talking here about Ohio Governor John Kasich, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. All of them have a proven appeal here in New Hampshire. The problem for them, though, is that they're all competing perhaps for the same pool of voters. So I think that's throwing some people off here. It's giving them a lot of choices. I've talked to voters who appreciate the choices, but I think a lot of voters waited to the very last minute to make a decision, and they were sort of having some trouble making that final decision.
How much trouble are the Democrats having in New Hampshire making a decision? I mean, they've only got two candidates to pick from, unlike all those Republicans, but still, it may not be an easy choice for some, right?
Oh, definitely. I talked to a gentleman in Merrimack today at the voting booth, and he had been voting earlier in the day, and he turned out to vote for Hillary Clinton, but he said he debated, you know, with himself long and hard, because in the end he described it as a kind of dilemma of the head versus the heart. I think the heart wanted to go with Bernie Sanders and that kind of more progressive vision for the Democratic Party in the country, but at the end of the day he thought that Clinton's experience mattered more, and that he felt more comfortable going with her as someone who would get things done. I think that encapsulates this dilemma right now that some of the Democrats are finding. And certainly here in New Hampshire, the scale seems to have weighed on Bernie Sanders' side, at least according to all the pre-primary polls.
Thank you so much to our national correspondent, Jim Malone, in New Hampshire.
Thank you.
Well, it's time for a check of what social media are saying about our top story, and International Edition's G. Abby Lee is with me in the studio to do just that. So, G, can you tell us what are the candidates tweeting today?
Hi, Michael. So it's really some old new things and some old things. The latest is from The Hill, a Washington-based newspaper. It reported Ben Carson is open to being Donald Trump's VP, that's a vice president. That is a big statement for somebody who is still vying for the Republican nomination.
He's not running for vice president, huh?
No, not really.
Okay.
Of course, there's also the news of former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg considering running as an independent. However, as you know, Bloomberg has been considering for a very long time, so it's hardly news for anyone who has been following domestic politics.
And apparently Bloomberg is saying that he sees the current field of candidates as an insult to the voters, mm-hmm. so maybe he can be a response to that insult. What is the Twitter campaign like for the other leading candidates today?
Well, the main message is urging eligible voters to come out and vote. Trump, who is very partial to using all caps in tweets, wrote this: New Hampshire, vote today. Make America great again. Jeb Bush sent out a similar message. Marco Rubio, for his part, tweeted, It's official. The FBI confirms it's investigating Hillary Clinton's private server.
Okay, well, what about Bush and Trump savaging each other on Twitter? Are they still doing that?
Not really, so thank God. But who knows? Maybe next day.
Okay, and what about the Democrats?
Hillary Clinton is saying that, actually incorporating a lot of Bill Clinton in her tweets. So a tweet sent out about 3 hours ago is a picture of Bill Clinton on the phone with a caption saying, checking in to say hi to Hillary on primary day in New Hampshire. Her rival, Bernie Sanders, is having a great day so far. A well-known statistician, Nate Silver, said Sanders' odds of winning Tuesday night is above 99%.
Even I might bet some money on an outcome
I
like
know,
that,
right?
Huh? Well, thank you very much, G. You can follow G on Twitter at GAbbyLee. And I'm on Twitter as well at Michael_Lippin. And you can follow our show as well. It is at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
A Tibetan singing bowl is played for a class at Unplugged Meditation in Los Angeles. This class is at a new so-called brain gym, a place for people to relieve stress in a fitness environment. Owner Suze Yalof-Schwartz says it was her mission to start a place that makes it easy for people to meditate.
Why is there no tri-bar of meditation where you kind of walk in feeling icky and walk out feeling great, and you learn it and you get it and you go?
Being stressed is not very fun.
People who meditate say the practice helps them to relax, focus, and even sleep better.
For me, it's helped me calm down a lot. It's relieved a lot of my stress. It's made all of my relationships better.
2014 research from Johns Hopkins University found moderate evidence that continued meditation does improve symptoms of anxiety, depression, and pain. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. There's a significant development in the Syrian civil war. Forces loyal to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad have advanced into rebel territory 25 kilometers from the Turkish border with northern Syria for the first time since August 2013. Those pro-Assad forces have been supported by a Russian-backed offensive that is throwing the moderate rebel forces into disarray. Middle East analyst Abdul Qadir Sino of Indiana University told VOA's Victor Beatty that Russian airstrikes on Syrian rebels have ushered in a major change in the direction of the conflict.
The opposition is in danger, and it is very likely that we'll end up with some of its members either giving up and leaving or joining even the Islamic State.
The city of Aleppo, is it controlled by the government or still by the rebel forces?
Part of it is still controlled by rebel forces. It's divided. There's one area that's still controlled by rebel forces, but now they are surrounded from all sides almost, with the lines of communication interrupted between them inside the city and outside the city.
So it's just a matter of time before they will have to surrender?
Yes, and we have seen that happen before in other parts of Syria, where the resistance is blockaded from all sides and the regime imposes a blockade, and when they just don't have enough food anymore to be able to survive, they have to give up.
This is causing a massive new refugee exodus out of northern Syria. Turkey is the direct object of this exodus. Turkish President Erdogan said on the weekend that Turkey is under threat. You have tens of thousands, perhaps as many as hundreds of thousands of refugees involved.
Yes, and Turkey already has hosted hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees. And even though the European Union has given Turkey several billion dollars to help it cope with that, as well as to keep refugees from going to Europe, that still may be too much for Turkey. Also, he may be posturing to prepare public opinion, both in Turkey and in Europe and the United States, for intervening more forcefully in Syria next door. There is a risk, indeed, that several Arab Gulf countries back more direct intervention. In fact, a Saudi diplomat has said that Saudi troops may someday intervene in Syria. Now, it's not likely that they would do it on their own, but they may be lobbying for a larger international intervention that would parallel that of Russia and counter it as well.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that. I have a story here that the United States has welcomed a Saudi offer to deploy special forces to support a coalition ground operation against Islamic State inside Syria. So you're saying this war could be further internationalized?
Yes, it will be. Unfortunately, the different goals of the different parties may make this intervention inefficient, because the Saudis and the Turks would like to support the resistance against the regime, much more so than against the Islamic State, while the United States and Europe are mostly focused on the Islamic State.
And that was Middle East analyst Abdelkader Sino of Indiana University speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Riot police in Hong Kong have fired warning shots into the air to break up a street confrontation with protesters in the city's working-class Mong Kok district. Tuesday's violence was the worst in Hong Kong since pro-democracy street protests in late 2014. My colleague Sarah Williams discussed the latest unrest with VOA Cantonese service reporter Dahai Han in Hong Kong and asked him how it all began.
According to TV footages, the clashes between the police and the protesters started overnight Monday night, which was the first day of Chinese Lunar New Year. And localist groups called on its supporters and the citizens to converge on Mong Kok area to support the unlicensed street food sellers who were tried to be removed by the city food and environmental hygiene department officials in the past days and also last year. The localist groups think those street food vendors and the so-called Lunar New Year night market, part of the local culture, which had been going on for years. And at the beginning, the police did not expect a large crowd, and the suspected did not deploy enough police power. At the one point, close to 2 o'clock, a group of about 10 traffic policemen were confronted by a large crowd of protesters, and one of the policemen stepped on wooden pallets and fell, and were also some of the protesters throw objects at the fallen policeman. And so one of his colleagues, also a traffic policeman, put out his gun and fired two shots, warning shots, in the air, which, according to media reports, were not allowed by police guidelines.
Was there any reason given as to why the police decided to do this? You know, this has been a tradition to have unlicensed food sellers participate in the New Year celebrations. Why this measure was taken?
Okay, the police were actually called to the scene by the food and the environmental hygiene department officials who were enforcing the laws to try to eradicate unlicensed food sellers. So that they actually, the food and environmental hygiene department decided to enforce the ongoing rules or regulations starting last year, when some of the night markets where unlicensed food sellers or vendors were selling local food. It's purely a government enforcement on the food and the environmental hygiene department.
And you were listening to VOA Cantonese service reporter Dahai Han speaking with International Edition's Sarah Williams. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Helicopter parenting describes a style of raising kids where parents are overcaring and overprotective, like a helicopter hovering over their children. There's a new book on the topic by author Julie Lithcott-Hames, and VOA's Faiza El-Masri tells us about it in this report narrated by Faith Lapidus.
Julie Lithcott-Hames got some firsthand experience with helicopter parenting when she worked as dean of first-year students at Stanford University. Incoming kids, she said, were brilliant and accomplished on paper, but many were incapable of taking care of themselves.
They were turning to parents constantly for guidance, for problem solving, to help them make a choice about something.
Oftentimes, she had to remind those parents that their kids were old enough to take care of themselves. One evening, though, she discovered that she might be a helicopter mom herself.
I came home one day, and my own kids were 8 and 10 at the time, and I leaned over at dinner, began cutting my 10-year-old son's meat. And I realized, oh my goodness, I'm overhelping my 10-year-old. He should be able to cut his own meat. It's my job to teach him. I haven't done that. I'm on track to being one of those parents. And that's when I began to develop real empathy for parents and realize we're overhelping with the best of intentions.
Overparenting, Lithcott-Hames says, comes in three types.
Overprotective, parent who thinks the world is scary and unsafe and unpredictable, and therefore I must protect and prevent. Second type is the over-directive type. This is a parent who says, I know best what leads to success, and you will do as I say. You will study these topics. You will do these activities. You will be, you know, highly achieving in all of it. The third type is the concierge, the parent who just wants to make life smoother, from waking their kid up to keeping track of their deadlines to making sure they haven't forgotten anything to having those tough conversations with a teacher to outright helping with the homework, maybe doing the homework for the kid.
Lithcott-Hames differentiates between the short-term benefits and the long-term cost of this kind of parenting.
If you're at the playground next to them, if they fall or slip, you're right there to catch them, and they do not suffer, you know, the bruised knee or whatever it might be. If you're helping with your kid's homework, they're going to get a better grade. Those are short-term wins. The long-term cost is if your kid doesn't learn how to manage their own body on a playground, which is a lesson only learned by falling a few times. They don't learn the long-term lesson. If you're always helping with their homework, what you're effectively telling them is, hey, kid, you're not capable of being a fourth grader. Don't worry, I'm going to help with your homework. They begin to feel less capable. They begin to feel very reliant upon parents to correct and perfect their academic work. It's not preparing them to be the persistent learners who will be successful in life.
So what can parents do if they want to break the hovering cycle within their own families?
We have to stop saying we when we mean our son or our daughter. All too often, a parent will say, we're on the travel soccer team. Well, no, your son is or your daughter is. The next thing is we have to stop arguing with all of the adults in our kids' lives. We need to teach our kids to advocate for themselves. The third thing is we must stop doing our kids' homework. The fourth thing is we've got to build skills. Teach them to cross the street. Teach them to make a meal. Teach them to remember to put their own items in their backpack, which becomes a briefcase one day.
When kids have all the skills they need to take care of themselves, Lithcott-Hames says, they will be prepared for adulthood. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Fans of the late American rock guitarist Jimi Hendrix will now get to see how he lived in the British capital, London. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the London apartment of Hendrix and his former girlfriend has been restored and opened as a museum.
Jimi Hendrix and his girlfriend Kathy Etchingham lived in the top floor flat of an 18th century house in London's Mayfair neighborhood in 1968 and 69. Now their former apartment has been faithfully restored to show what life was like for the guitar genius at the height of his career. Persian rugs are on the floor, a Victorian shawl hangs above the bed, and a clamshell ashtray sits on a nightstand. Another room has a wall of album covers, including Hendrix's Are You Experienced?, his first album with drummer Mitch Mitchell and bass player Noel Redding. Some of Hendrix's own collection, including a copy of Bob Dylan's Highway 61 Revisited, stained with the guitarist's own blood, are also on display. Dr. Christian Lloyd is a professor at Queen's University and the author of a new book, Hendrix at Home, A Blues Man in Mayfair. He says Hendrix had the advantage of having no neighbors when he rented the flat, so he could make music at high volume if he wanted to.
One of the great advantages of living here was that there were no neighbors. It wasn't really a residential street at that time. So you could play music as loud as you liked, and they did. I think it was a kind of place where, after they'd been to the speakeasy, so one of the music clubs, just 5 or 10 minutes walk away, they'd come back here later and hang out and so on. So, yeah, Jimmy was 25 when he was here. So, yeah, they had some fun, yeah.
The display also features Jimi Hendrix's acoustic guitar, an Epiphone FT-79, which was always within arm's reach.
That guitar was always leaned up against the bed there. It was always within hand's reach. He composed many of his most famous songs on that guitar, not on an electric guitar, actually. And she said, you know, he'd play and play and play. You know, people think of Hendrix as a genius. He was also someone who worked really, really hard on his music.
The apartment at 23 Brook Street is next to the former house of composer George Friedrich Handel. It was originally office space for the Handel House Museum, but so many people visited Hendrix's old apartment that a temporary exhibition was mounted 5 years ago. That was such a success that museum directors decided to open a permanent exhibition in the flat. Barry Wenzel is a former photographer for Melody Maker magazine who photographed Jimi Hendrix in the flat in the 1960s. Some of his images are on display in the exhibit. He says he thinks that Jimmy would be pleased.
Every time I hear that, Hey Joe on the radio, I'm back in the darkroom again. The music and the pictures are on mnemonic to bring you back into that, and I think it's very important for the younger generation who don't know that world of freedom and hippiness and money wasn't an issue, and hey, you walk down the street and there's Jimmy Page or Richie Blackmore, or you go to the speakeasy and there's Keith Moon destroying somebody's drum and drinking somebody to the floor in the bar.
The Jimi Hendrix House Museum opens to the public February 10th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
That's a wrap of International Edition on the Voice of America. Your director today was Tracy Carter, the engineer was Dan Crafton, and I'm Michael Lippin in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking in Kigali, Rwanda, U.S. Secretary of Commerce Penny Pritzker, at the beginning of her visit to that country late January, discussed the commitment of the United States towards strengthening economic trade with the East African community. Secretary Pritzker said, "Today I am joined in Kigali by the group of senior executives who comprise the President's Advisory Council on Doing Business in Africa. Their charge is to provide recommendations to President Obama and me on policy steps we can take to strengthen commercial engagement between the United States and countries across Africa, including how to build lasting partnerships between the U.S. and African private sectors. Rwanda and the East African community have a lot to offer U.S. investors," said Secretary Pritzker. "East Africa is the most integrated and fastest-growing regional economic community in Africa. The PACDBIA members, as representatives of the American business community, have had the opportunity to share their perspectives on policies that can foster deeper economic trade ties between the East African community and the United States. As part of this visit, our delegation met with President Kagame for a roundtable discussion on the opportunities presented by regional integration. While we continue to deepen our commercial relationships, our delegation arrived at a challenging moment," said Secretary Pritzker. "The United States has expressed its disappointment that President Kagame has chosen to run for a third term in 2017. We believe that respecting established term limits can strengthen democratic institutions and help build a vibrant and free society. The relationship between the United States and Rwanda is deep and mature," said Secretary Pritzker. "The depth of our relationship does not mean we never have disagreements," the secretary noted. "Rather, the depth of our relationship means that we discuss disagreements openly and candidly, and we work together to address them."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.